I'm Emily Cureton in for Jeffrey Riley today, and our guest is Dr. Carl Safina. Have you ever wondered what an elephant thinks about, or maybe what a whale is feeling? Scientists have long studied animal behaviorism, but few have asked who rather than what they were dealing with. Dr. Carl Safina took a different approach in his latest book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. This book does not examine how animals are like people, but instead how animals simply are. The recipient of MacArthur, Pew, and Guggenheim Fellowships, Dr. Safina has a PhD in ecology from Rutgers University and teaches at Stony Brook University in New York. He's hosted a 10-part series on PBS called Saving the Ocean with Carl Safina and has written for the New York Times, National Geographic, among many other notable publications. Beyond Words is his seventh book. Dr. Carl Safina, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for joining us today. I've noticed you encourage people to go out and see animals and try to understand them. What's in it for the animals?
Well, one of the reasons that we're doing such terrible things to animals is that we don't realize that we are. And the more we appreciate them, the more that we see what's there and understand what's there and understand a little bit about who they are and how they. Their lives are vivid to them, and their lives are valid. And the more that we understand that, the more that we can leave them some room, which is, really all I'm asking, and all they need.
So your new book, you've written six books before it. Where did the idea come from for Beyond Words?
Well, a couple of places. One is that I wanted to circle back to my initial interest, which is really just what do animals do and why do they do it? That's what I've always been interested in since I was a little child. And almost all of my professional work has been on ocean conservation. And one of the things about conservation is that we always talk about it by the numbers. We say that they're down by 60%. They've lost half their habitat. There are only 3,000 of them left. That's why they're going on the endangered species list. And that tells you a little bit about what's at stake, but not really too much because that's just all numbers. And what I wanted to show is who is at stake. Who lives out there? Who lives around us? Who do we share this planet with? What minds are here with us?
Now, in your book, there's a section of it where you are meeting with an elephant researcher. Elephants are one of the species you focus on in the book. I'd like to talk a little bit later about how you chose which animals to research. But this moment seems to have been a seminal one for you when you were with Cynthia Moss, who you describe as a young woman in her 70s. And she says something that really turns your thinking on its head. Can you tell us about that moment?
Yeah, I was interested in understanding what the study of animals tells us about ourselves. So I asked her, what does watching elephants for 40 years, what has that helped you learn about humans? And she said, I'm really not interested in that question. I'm interested in learning about elephants. And I, other than feeling very stupid all of a sudden, I realized that, she was really right. When you say, how are they like us? We put the focus back on us again. We can't stop talking about ourselves. We're such incredible narcissists. All we want to know about is us, us, us. And she was saying, there are other things here. I'm studying elephants. That's what I want to know about. We know plenty about people. And comparing elephants to people, or saying how a raven or a chimpanzee performs compared to a human toddler on a certain kind of test in a laboratory is not interesting to me. And it really took me aback. And it took me a few days to realize that the question is not how are they like us? The question is how are they, like us or not? And who are they? And so that really became the way that I focused on, sort of refocused my lens in looking at everything.
Well, and the title of your book is Beyond Words. So presumably how animals are, who they are, is beyond words. How do you go about using words to get at that?
Yeah, right. Well, there are different ways in, and there are a few different ways in. One is that we can look at the brain, and we can compare brains, and we see by that there are tremendous similarities that are all inherited because all life is on a continuum. There are no sharp breaks. So We have many brain structures that many other animals have. We got it from them. We have many brain chemicals that create our moods and our motivations and really create our minds that are exactly the same chemicals as are in other brains. So we say, okay, well, we start out with having brains that are quite similar. And this was not known, you know, 60 or 70 years ago. This is all fairly new stuff. And only in the 1960s have people who are still alive started watching wild animals live their lives in any kind of formal way. So we know something about their brains, and now we have people who have watched and seen what they do. And what we see is that they make sense of their world in a way that makes sense to us. We can see that they are frightened when there is danger, that they are protective when there's a threat to their young ones or to themselves or to their mates, that they patrol and defend their territories, that they relax when things are safe and calm, but they might relax by letting the babies lie down but still be standing up, being a little bit vigilant just in case something happens. All of those things make total sense to us. And so one of the things I say about that is we can see their minds working in the logic of their behaviors and the decisions that they make. So there are these various different ways. And then we can also manipulate them. We can see that when dogs, for instance, have obsessive-compulsive disorder or they have anxiety disorder, or even animals that are earlier than vertebrates, like crayfish, have anxiety that is induced in them by giving them little electrical shocks so that they don't want to go out and leave their shelter anymore. If you give them anti-anxiety drugs that are used on people, they relax and they start exploring. They lose their anxiety. If you give them the same drugs that are used for people with obsessive-compulsive disorder, the dogs don't have obsessive-compulsive disorder anymore while they're on those drugs. So we can say that the mind is working in the same way, and they're feeling the same things, and we can get at that by manipulating it with using those kinds of drugs. And the other thing is we simply can just think about the logic of the things that we do to animals. For instance, if we want to test whether cosmetics are going to sting our eyes, we test them on the eyes of rabbits to see if the rabbits sting. Well, obviously, they're having those experiences, right? And we're actually using those experiences. So those are the ways in.
A lot of topics to cover here about what animals think and feel with author and ecologist Dr. Carl Safina, our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation after a short break. Phone number 800-838-3760 or email jx@jeffnet.org. That's 800-838-3760. We'll be back with Dr. Carl Safina in a minute 10. It's 9:21 and we're back on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your guest host today, Emily Curitan, stepping in for Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Dr. Carl Safina, an ecologist and author of Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Dr. Safina joins us today to talk about his new book and what animals think and feel. So, Dr. Safina, you focused on particular animals in this book, animals that, like humans, tend to form very close relationships and social bonds. Can you talk more about that and specifically about what's going on with the brains of animals that have this in common?
Well, the brains are very similar, but what they have in common that is more important in this regard, I think, is that they live in structured social groups. So what I mean by structured social groups is they live in groups where the individuals have relationships with one another that are very important. In some kinds of animals, like a big flock of birds, for instance, the individuals are just grouped up. They don't have leaders and followers, and they don't have individual relationships. But in families of elephants or wolves or whales, all the individuals know exactly who they are. They know who their friends are in other families that they encounter. They know who their rivals are. They understand who their enemies are. They know their territory. They aspire toward higher status, and then they get deposed, and their life follows the arc of a career. So those animals whose social lives are structured along the same lines that human social groups are structured are the ones whose minds effectively work rather similar to ours, because they are defined by who they are specifically among individuals, and they have bonds, and they have other relationships. You know, they have competitive relationships or enemies or rivals as well.
So which animals did you study in depth for this book, Beyond Words?
There are dozens of species in the book by reference, but the ones that I focused on being out in the wild with in depth are savanna elephants in Africa, wolves in Yellowstone National Park, and killer whales in the Pacific Northwest.
And this kind of brings me back to our first question. All of these animals have been driven to the brink of extinction. Is the relationship between humans and these species, how is it doing? Is it repairable?
Well, sure, it's repairable, but it's not going in the right direction. So, you know, we're just taking up more and more of the world. The thing about this book is I wanted to get away from writing about conservation all the time and give myself a little bit of a breather from that. And I went to some of the most protected populations of these species, these elephants in some of the national parks and reserves in Kenya, the wolves of Yellowstone National Park, the killer whales of the Pacific Northwest that are designated endangered and so are supposedly the most protected ones that we have. And what I found was that I could not write honestly about their lives and what they do without writing about what they do to avoid getting killed by people, and how often, in fact, they are killed by people, and how that changes the trajectory of the lives of the survivors. In these tight-knit groups with these deep social bonds, especially where the young ones depend on learning how to live and where the food is and what to do during droughts and food shortages, and they rely on the elders that have lived through that in their memories. When those elders are killed, the families shatter. The survival rate among the survivors drops. The reproduction among the survivors drops. Their fights and rivalries break out as they scramble for status in sort of a power vacuum, and which I saw very much with the wolves. And you know, even in the most protected populations, we have them so hemmed in on all corners. And with the elephants, there's just this tremendous catastrophe happening with the ivory poaching. With the wolves, wolves are so hated by many ranchers that as soon as they leave the park, many of them get shot. And then what happens as the packs break up, and the young ones are wandering around, they're more inclined to attack livestock than they were before when the packs were intact. So that makes the problem worse.
Right. And wolves in particular, here in our region, the number of wolves kind of making a comeback in Oregon can be quantified in two digits.
Yeah.
Is that a major concern you've seen? It's that these leaders get knocked out and the younger animals don't know how to behave or exist in a human-dominated world?
Well, they just get hungry, you know, and the packs know what to do, and they have the skill to do it, and they have the wisdom of the elders to avoid encountering people in dangerous situations like that. So if the elders get taken out and the young ones are just wandering around starving, they'll definitely be attacking sheep and cats and whatever else they can get to try to stay alive. So that does make the situation worse. And then with the killer whales, the Navy is still dropping live bombs in the range of these endangered whales.
Mm-hmm.
The salmon are at historic lows. Those are the salmon that they rely on for food. So survival of their babies is poor because they're not well nourished.
Mm-hmm.
They're living in toxic chemicals in many of those areas around Puget Sound and that kind of thing. That's bad for their babies. It's bad for their immune system as well. So we're really making the world deteriorate terribly as far as their survival prospects. And many of these animals had gigantic ranges, before the Industrial Revolution, let's say. Elephants used to range the entire continent of Africa from the Mediterranean shores to the Cape of Good Hope. Now they're in a few refuges and getting into all kinds of trouble if they leave those refuges and national parks. The same thing, as we've just been talking about with the wolves. Same thing with the killer whales. Some of those pods of killer whales are doomed, actually. They don't have the females that are there are past reproductive age. There's no way out for them. Some of those pods will blink out as they die of attrition. So could we turn all that around? Yeah, we easily could turn that around. All we need to do is give them room and stop killing them. But that's a lot easier said than it is actually done.
We're talking today with Dr. Carl Safina, an ecologist and author of Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. You're welcome to take part in the conversation as it unfolds. Phone number is 800-838-3760. That's 800-838-3760. Let's go ahead and take a call from Lucy in Mendocino. Lucy, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. My question is, are you there?
Yes, yep. We're here.
Yeah, okay. My question is, have you ever studied the goats family? I have a herd of Nubian goats, and what you're saying is what I deal with management. My husband and I have a nice flock, and we're quite aware of all these attributes for the animals. It's really quite fun. And good luck with the wild animals. They need feed, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you for that, Lucy. So, Dr. Safina.
No, I haven't studied goats. Goats are one of the groups of animals that I have almost absolutely no firsthand experience with, except that I've seen some of the wild goats. But George Schaller, one of the first people to really study animals systematically in the wild, he got very famous for his pioneering studies of lions in the early 1960s. He has studied wild sheep and goats quite a lot, George Schaller. He's still alive, and he's still working.
Well, and Lucy brings up an interesting point, the different attitudes we have between wild animals and domesticated animals and some of the grazing species where you can still see their wild ancestors in a goat. Did you account for that in your book, or were you solely concerned with animals that are wild? And does the definition of wild change in a world where habitat destruction is so rampant?
Well, I call them free living for a couple of reasons. One is that the word wild has certain kinds of connotations and baggage. And, these animals, they're not, to themselves, they're not wild. They're just living. And the other thing is that I tried to portray the natural lives of free living animals, and I found that they're up against people at every turn. So there's not the wildness in that kind of pristine sense in almost any of these living things that are out in the world. We're everywhere, and they're constantly having to encounter and cope with us. And the other thing is the book does talk about wild versus domesticated animals, the animals that are in their original form, their natural form, versus the ones that we have changed through selective breeding, and what those changes are, how they happen, how similar they are among animals and why that is, and how even humans seem to have inadvertently self-domesticated to a certain extent.
How do you mean?
Well, we have some of the same traits that our domestic animals have compared to our wild forms. We took wild animals and we selected the ones who could cope with living in crowded conditions, being more tractable, more easily conforming. The ones that would be able to do well in a settled, pretty boring kind of a life. And while we were doing that, we were doing the exact same thing to ourselves. So we see certain things. For instance, all the domesticated animals they develop a variable hair color and hair texture, and we see that in people. They have flatter faces. People have very flat faces. They have smaller teeth than their wild counterparts. We have smaller teeth than older humans in fossils. They get smaller brains. Their brains shrink by about 10%. Our brains are 10% smaller than Neanderthals. There's a lot of reproductive behavior outside the reproductive season that does not result in pregnancy and birth. People show that as well. So there are all those parallels.
Oh, we have some callers on the line who want to talk about more domesticated animals, cows and cats in particular, although I'd kind of like to stick with what you're calling free-living animals, in particular the whales that you got to know in the course of writing Beyond Words, your latest book. Can you tell us more about that experience? You know, I think it's worth noting as well that the coast of Oregon is part of the Northwest Testing and Training Area for the U.S. Navy. You alluded to that briefly. Maybe you could elaborate more on how whales, which would seemingly live in very different habitat than humans, are coming into contact with humans and what the repercussions are.
Yes, right. So these were killer whales specifically that I was focusing on, and they are astonishing, astonishing animals. They are incredibly smart. They do things that are really mysterious and really inexplicable. For instance, they help people from time to time, and I don't know why really they would want to do that, but researchers who have been completely lost in fog have suddenly been surrounded by the whales that they were researching, and the whales, in two well-documented cases, have gotten in front of the boat, and they followed them, and they led them 15 miles or so through the fog until the fog opened up, and they delivered them basically right to the homes of the researchers, and then they left in the opposite direction immediately. Why in the world, and how in the world, would they do that, or think about that, or value the lives of human beings? No killer whale has ever hurt a person in the wild. And why would that be? Why would they care about us? These are animals that are eating seals all the time. We're pretty much like seals. You know, we're mammals that weigh 100 to 200 pounds on average. We are out there in little kayaks. We're very vulnerable, and they don't hurt us at all. There was a killer whale orphan deep in a fjord in British Columbia for 6 years, and he was lonely. He was acoustically isolated, so he could never hear his family calling, and he was really lost up there. And he was lonely, so he was always trying to play with people. If he wanted to play with a 40-foot sailboat, he'd give it a big shove. If he wanted to play with two women in a kayak, he would come and give a tiny little gentle nudge. Now, why and how could a killer whale understand at some level that if two women wind up in that water, they may die? He's perfectly at home in the water. Why would he care about them?
Exactly.
So it's so mysterious, and it's so incredible. So they're living off our coast. We, first of all, shattered these pods during the time when the whales were being caught for the aquariums and the entertainment centers like SeaWorld, et cetera, and really depleted their numbers a lot, enough so that the reproductive potential of many of those pods was so badly affected that a couple of them are now doomed, as I mentioned. The remaining females are past reproductive age, and there's really no hope for a couple of those pods. They're swimming around in areas where the Navy is still practicing with dropping live bombs in the water, and there's constant noise from ships. The fishing boats are depleting their food. The dams and the logging have depleted the salmon that are the main food for the fish-eating pods. There are some pods that eat only fish, never touch a seal, and there are others that eat only marine mammals and never touch a fish. That's another really strange thing about them. They seem to have these learned cultural differences that are have no parallel in anywhere else among wild animals, except in human societies, where we have cultural differences where we don't you know, we completely avoid certain people only because we weren't born in their group and they weren't born in our group. And killer whales are the only ones that seem to do something very similar among themselves. So so there are these free-living killer whales out there, and you think, you know, they're the wildest and freest kind of thing, but they're not. They're having all kinds of issues to deal with because we're doing so many different things to the coastal ocean that we are unavoidable in their realm. If we want to avoid killer whales, we can just easily stay home, but they cannot avoid us.
And how much time did you spend for this book with whale expert Ken Balcom, and how did that go?
Yeah, I've known Ken for a few years, and I spent some time with him. I'm trying to think of exactly how many days. It was about a week and a half or something like that. And we were out every day, and we were with the various pods every day. And actually, when you're in Ken's home, it's like being out on the water because his home is perched right on a hill right next to Harrow Strait. He's constantly listening to the hydrophones that are bringing the calls of these pods. Whenever they're anywhere in the vicinity of the hydrophones, they may be miles from his house. He knows if they're coming. You can hear them in his kitchen. You step right out onto his kitchen deck. It's like being on the deck of a boat. I mean, it's really fantastic to spend time with him.
And he spent decades following the same whales, right?
He's been at it for about 40 years, yes.
Mm-hmm.
He knows them probably better as individuals than anybody, definitely better than anybody in the United States.
Well, we'll hear more from Dr. Carl Safina, author of Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, after a short break here on the Jefferson Exchange. We've got a few callers on the line. Thank you for calling us. We'll get to your questions in a minute 30. And we're back on the Jefferson Exchange. It's 8:41. I'm Emily Curitan in for Jeffrey Riley today. Our guest is Dr. Carl Safina, and we've been talking about what animals think and feel. Who, not what, are animals? Let's pause in the discussion here to take a few calls from listeners. Grumpy John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I have a neighbor who has a small herd of free-range grass-fed cattle. The kill truck came out to butcher one of the cows. They separated the herd out, and the butchering process was underway. One of the herd mates got back through the gate and came over to where we were. When he or she saw what was going on, the look on his face when he looked at me was one of incomprehensible terror that we should be doing this. And the lamentation, the sound was just obvious agony for his littermate. The cow was dead, it was separated, but he knew that his friend was being butchered, and it just appalled him. Thank you.
All right, thank you for that, Grumpy John in Grants Pass. A response from Dr. Carl Safina. I think this raises some interesting points about, if we start to think of animals as who, what does that mean for how we treat them?
Well, you know, that's a question we've had to ask about other human beings as well, that we objectified and we denied that other kinds of humans could feel love, for instance, so we could make slaves of them and separate their families. It didn't matter. We said that they had no sense of aesthetics. We dehumanized other humans, and we've certainly dehumanized other animals. And it's not that other animals are human beings. It's that other animals have lives and thoughts and feelings that are their own, and many of them are not too dissimilar for instance, you know, if you were going to kill a pig and the pig was screaming, please don't kill me, please don't kill me, you might hesitate. But the pig is screaming, please don't kill me, please don't kill me. It's just screaming that in its own voice. If it was saying it in French or Chinese and you didn't speak French or Chinese, it would still be saying, please don't kill me. You know, that's what the pig is saying. And we act like we have no idea about this because obviously it makes it easier for us to do whatever we want if we don't have to consider what it means for them. I've had other kinds of animals in captivity and, you know, domestic animals. And at the level of animals that you would really assume life doesn't, you know, they don't really know the difference between life and death. They're not really concerned about other individuals. If you tune into them, you see that that's not true. You know, we had, for instance, we had a we have chickens that we have loose in our yard. They wander around our yard and the neighbor's yard, and they're loose all day, and they're very happy out there. And we had a rooster that I had acquired somewhat accidentally. Anyway, the rooster was really annoying our neighbors, and I had to give the rooster away. So I went to where the chickens were out in the yard, and they were all hanging around. And I went and I got the rooster, and I brought the rooster to the coop because I had to catch him. And I put him in the coop, and I closed the door. Now, I simply put him in the coop that they all sleep in every night, in the coop that they had grown up in. And the other chickens were following me. When I put him in there, they were looking at him through the mesh. And it was kind of like, you know, why is our friend suddenly in jail? They couldn't understand it, but they knew that something was wrong and something was up. They obviously were not comfortable with whatever was going on. We also had two ducks that were inseparable. And when the drake suddenly one day got sick and died in the span of just about 10 hours, he just didn't feel good, and then he was dead. And for weeks after that, the female was going around the yard looking and quacking and calling and looking and calling, and eventually she just... you know, she just had to reckon with the fact that she wasn't going to find him. But he was on her mind for a long time, and she really was, in her way, at her level, she was grieving for her lost companion and searching for him. And eventually she just had to kind of give up on it and pal around more closely with the chickens. But, you know, it's because of those things that I don't really feel comfortable eating meat anymore, or eating the meat of farmed animals. I think he was talking about animals that seem to be kept very well, free range, grass fed. They probably had nice lives, but for many of the animals that whose meat we eat, I think they're made to live far worse than they're made to die, actually. So I don't really want to have much part of that myself in my own personal life, and I think that that's a decision for individuals to make. I don't want to do too much moralizing, but when you see that their lives, you know, their lives mean enough to them that they're always trying to stay alive, and wild animals or free-living animals or even domestic animals, if they're kept well, they value their lives. They're not, you never see a free-living animal that is suffering from depression or self-loathing is a totally human kind of thing. Suicide is something that never seems to be done by any free-living animals at all. And
have you found any free-living animals as obsessed with measuring intelligence as human beings are?
Well, a thing about our measures of intelligence is that we do everything to systematically exclude the ways in which other animals are superior to us. They, we have an instinct for complicated language. we learn it as babies automatically. It's an instinctive ability that is a template in our brain that lets us do this. So instead of just saying, wow, that's really super interesting, and this is a really powerful thing that we can do, we take credit for it. We act like we're so smart because we can talk. Well, other animals can find their way home across thousands of miles of totally trackless ocean. They can do things like fly. They have superhuman response times. They have superhuman strength. They have, they have other instincts. They have maternal instincts. They have protective instincts, all these kinds of things. And we totally discount that. We say, well, that has nothing to do with intelligence. But really, our ability to speak has nothing to do with intelligence. It's just an attribute that that we've developed in our evolution, and it's very powerful for us. But we act like we deserve credit for it, and all the other things that make other animals special in their ways, we don't give them any credit for that, because then we would have to admit that in those ways they are better than us. So it's a very strange double standard that shows that in some way one of the most significant sorts of human attributes is that we're very, very insecure. We have to constantly, at almost every turn, keep reassuring ourselves that in every way we are the best. And it's not true that in every way we are the best. In some ways, we are the kindest and most compassionate, but we also, at the same time, are the most violent and most destructive animals. And we need to really own all of it, or we can't give ourselves any credit for any of it.
Mm-hmm. Seem the only species perhaps keeping score on these kinds of things. I want to talk more about the different gifts that different animals have, different ways of measuring intelligence. First, let's take a call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Wolfgang, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
This is an amazing subject, Carl. And I don't know where to start, so I'm going to, as usual, try to limit it. The bottom line to me seems to be otherization for the purpose of greed. So, as you noted, we have called native people of all kinds of geographic areas savages and non-human for the purpose of taking their natural resources, enslaving them, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this whole area, we put them in concentration camps all over the place. So that's the one extreme, and I think it addresses the fundamental why is all this happening, because we are dissociated from life. And on the other end, if you look at some native peoples who have totem animals, who take on animal names, who are giving association with animals, who live, even if they kill them, they live with them. They have an awareness of exactly what you were talking about, the powers, the superiorities, the, oh, wow, I would like to have that. Or maybe I feel a trace of that sense of awareness, blah, blah, all that stuff, right? But that's sort of the two poles of that insanity. And I wonder what can be done to penetrate the self-serving dissociation.
So let me pick up on those points, because we could talk about that for an hour alone. But the many native people, what we call native peoples, people who are still living in the place where they basically developed their cultures. Many of these people had a better deal with the world. That's one way that I think of it, is what kind of deal have we made with the world? Many people have made a pretty effective deal with the world that lasted for them for thousands of years. And part of it had to do with where the balance of power was. Many of those people did not have very powerful technologies. Most of them had nothing more powerful than a bow and arrow. They were very tuned into the world around them, and they were very impressed and very respectful of the attributes of other animals. They also knew that they relied on other animals and were afraid that if they abused that relationship, the other animals would withhold or would or would withdraw or would go away. And in a lot of sense, that is the way it works. Then with the cultures that got much more powerful, which were mostly the Western cultures, that respect eroded. But not just toward wild animals, to other kinds of people as well. Mm-hmm. And what we see is that the Western culture, and I think that's simply because of the power of the weapons that were developed, became a culture of aggression and domination. And whether we're talking about people or animals, the main theme seems to be that the strong obliterate the weak and push them out, take what they have. But humans now do that really almost everywhere to animals. Human expansion, as our populations grow and with the technology that most people now have available to them. Most people have guns of some sort and have tools and vehicles and technology enough to really expand our farms and our roads and our footprint. Not much thought at all is given to who and what gets pushed out of the way. Many people get pushed out of the way, but essentially all of the animals get pushed out of the way. And the main reason for that is they can't mount an effective resistance. They can't fight back, and so they're not thought of. And I think it's as simple as that. But we are capable of understanding that, and if we play to the best in us, which is our sense of compassion, we would be capable of overcoming that and making a better deal with the world. But we're not always rational about that. People like to say, humans are the rational animal. But in fact, humans are the only irrational animal. All other animals only believe the evidence that they see around them. Humans are the only ones that believe things that aren't there. We believe, we kill each other over differences in our beliefs about spiritual questions. Or ideologies or money and things like that don't truly exist.
Well, Dr. Carl Safina, thank you so much for joining us on today's Jefferson Exchange. Carl Safina is the author of Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. He's also the author of 6 other books, many articles, and engaged in a lot of conservation issues. Thank you for being on the program today, Dr. Safina.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a really, really delightful program. Thank you.
You bet. All right, that about does it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We also provide our show topics and recordings of all of our segments on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter or at that website, jeffexchange.org. I'm Jefferson Exchange producer Emily Curitin in for Jeffrey Riley today. Colleen Pike is at the controls.